Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Saturday, March 12th, 2016. This is episode 1269. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by NatureBox. NatureBox is dedicated to making smart, delicious snacking easy. They have over 100 ridiculously delicious snacks that get delivered directly to your doorstep. Visit naturebox.com/twit and get 50% off your first box now. And by Corning Optical Cables. Corning's incredibly durable Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 optical cables are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to opticalcablesbycorning.com to learn more. And by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo's the phone number, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, outside that area. Well, of course, you can call us via Skype. Won't cost you anything. Love to talk about many, many things today. Fascinating end to an amazing matchup in the classic Asian game of Go. G-O, it's called. You know, in the chess world, we kind of went through this about a couple of decades. Well, it seems like it's almost a couple of decades ago. When IBM's Deep Blue beat the world champion of chess, Garry Kasparov, it was a shocker for chess players. A computer can play better than the best human. That was in 1996. It was exactly 20 years ago. Actually, Kasparov won in 1996. And humans breathed a sigh of relief. The year later, Deep Blue won. The first defeat of a reigning world champion by a computer under tournament conditions. And at first, everybody said, that's the end of chess. It's it. If a machine can play better than a human, why bother? That didn't last long. In fact, kind of a beautiful human symbiosis, machine symbiosis was created. Chess players today use computers to study, to practice, as sparring partners. And, of course, there's strict rules against using computers in competitive play, although the rumors constantly swirl that some are doing so. But we've learned to live with our silicon overlords. But everybody looked at the game of Go and said, well, a computer will never be able to play that game. It's more complicated than chess. There's only two kinds of pieces, black and white, yours and the other guy's. They're all little stones, and they're laid out on a 19 by 19 grid. Chess is 8 by 8, and, of course, chess has, six different kinds of pieces. So it's more complicated and less complicated. Go is very subtle game. It's a game of kind of conquest of territory by moving your pieces, surrounding the other guy's pieces. And if you watch the matches at all over the last few days, you probably realize, wow, this is a hard game. And for a long time, computers just couldn't do it. Didn't even try. Then along comes something called AlphaGo, a computer system like Deep Blue, designed to play Go, this time by the Google folks. It wasn't against the world champion, but it was a match against a guy who's been the world champion in Go 18 times. I think that counts. And is widely considered to be in the top five, maybe the top three of all Go players in the world. So certainly one of the best humans. And AlphaGo just won a 5-game match against Lee Sedol. 1-2-3. Boom, boom, boom. And in an even more convincing manner than a Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov 20 years ago. I mean, just whooped him. It's all over. It's all over. And I just want to, there are not many Go players in the West, but just want to reassure you, we've been through this as chess players. We've been through this. That's going to be fine. But it's kind of an amazing thing. I think what we're realizing is that games like chess and Go are calculable. They can be, they're solvable. A computer given enough power, and that's really the only issue, can solve it. Now, Go's harder. There's so many more possibilities. And it's kind of more subtle in terms of judging the positions. It's a deep, deep game. It took us a little longer, 2 decades longer, in fact, to figure out how a machine could play it. AlphaGo can look at 10,000 or more positions a second. But frankly, Go is so complicated that I don't think it really can solve any given position. It could just... It's just going to make like a human does. I'll make the best move I can see. In this case, good enough to win the game. Really, really fascinating. Nodrog in our chat room says, "Well, I'm a Go Fish champion." Computer could probably beat you at that too. But really, this is kind of we as humans. I think when something's really hard to do, we assume that it's kind of infinite, then the intuition will win because we can't calculate it to the end, but a computer can. And it is solvable. It is chess, even though there are billions of possible positions, it's possible for a computer to look at any one position and go all the way to the end and solve, and in effect, solve it. Say, this is the right move, period. No matter what happens, this is the right move. Go may be a little harder to do that with. I don't think we're there yet, but there's nothing to say that it can't be done. It's just a matter of throwing more power and memory at it, more computation at it. But then there are things that humans do, I hope, I think, I pray, as a human, that no computer can do, and those are the things with intuition. Some things are very hard to do. It turns out face recognition is very hard, but computers are getting better and better at it. Voice recognition, the ability to understand your speech and act on it, very hard, but computers are getting better and better at it, aren't they? And I suppose we're going to live in a time, maybe even in our own lifetimes, where these things will be commonplace. And just computer, just solve it. What did you say? Oh, yeah, I understand what you're talking about. But I still think, I believe, and it's belief, that there are things that human minds can do that are somehow magical and beyond pure computation. Not sometimes hard to figure out what that thing might be. I guess we call it intuition. Feeling. Emotion. I don't know. What do you think? Isn't everything ultimately kind of deterministic? That you could just, you know, start at first principles and just figure it all out? Or is that not the case? Tell you where there's a mismatch right now, and that's between math, which is like that. Math is hard. But it's calculable. It's deterministic. And politics, which is, you know, if you're going to pick one thing the humans do, that would be the hardest for a computer to do, is negotiate, to compromise. We're having a hard time doing it, but in the United States, but it's something that we do. That's what politics is, isn't it? Is you know, considering the other guy's interests, figuring out strategically how to get the best deal you can, but making the other guy, you know, not crushing the other guy necessarily. I mean, sometimes we try to. Maybe that's not the best strategy. You know, that's what humans are particularly built for. From years and years of evolution, of having to kind of survive in groups, things like that. We're seeing that conflict right now. And that's the conflict between cryptography, which is math, the ability to just scramble something so nobody can unscramble it, period. The math wins, versus politics that says the math can't win. President Obama said Friday that smartphones can't be allowed to be black boxes inaccessible to government. He says the technology industry should work with government. You can't take And this is where it's telling. He's speaking at the big tech conference, South by Southwest, yesterday. You can't take an absolutist view on this. Yes, you can, because you know what? The math does. The math is absolute. Politics is not. But there's no compromise in math. He says, if your argument is strong encryption no matter what, and what we can and should create black boxes, I think that does not strike the kind of balance we've lived with for 200 to 300 years, and it's fetishizing our phones above every other value. And I agree. I understand. I completely agree with that. But there's a problem. The math. The math is done. Crypto exists. And there's nothing you can do to stop it, basically. No politics can stop it. Period. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You can say, oh, no, no, we don't want these to be encrypted. And you can even make every law, you can prohibit it, and some guy in Lithuania is going to make an encryption, and you're done. You can't stop everybody in the world from doing encryption. And governments will, of course, try, because that's what governments do. But you know what? Doesn't matter, because the math is out there. It's done. It's done. So there's 70 different countries now you can get strong encryption from, unbreakable encryption from. And so all you do, and I'm sure somebody will pull the president aside and explain this, I hope, to him. All you do is you cripple U.S. companies in the global marketplace where encryption is widely available. And we did it once before. We tried to with export restrictions on strong encryption, right? Oh, we own it. You can't have it. And you know what that did? That made us vulnerable in our browsers to this day. To this day, 40-bit encryption was built into browsers because we couldn't export it. And a browser company is going to say, well, I can't keep people from using Firefox in the United States and the same Firefox in Russia, so I'm going to put 40-bit encryption in Firefox. Actually, it was Netscape back then. And as a result, we have to continue to support 40-bit encryption. They're slowly, finally phasing it out, which is bad encryption. It's breakable encryption. So the U.S. government, by law, by fiat, said, well, you have to have breakable encryption if you're going to export it. We can have it here in the United States, and they should have learned that lesson then. National borders do not respect math. They just don't. They don't know. Math does not respect national. Math doesn't know from national. Math goes, guess what? A guy wore a T-shirt with the code, the strong encryption code that was classified as munitions in the United States, wore a T-shirt, walked across the border. It's math. It's not even hard math. So that's the real challenge, is that I don't think politics really gets that, politicians really get it, that it's not a question of not compromising. It just is. It exists. And you just have to live with it. It exists. And so you can make laws all you want. Apple could agree. Companies could agree. And then all that would do is make American companies weak. And, of course, in the long run, and this is what Apple's trying to explain, because we've already seen this, it would give us it would make us vulnerable forever. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, powered by math. So the problem is, we've seen this before, where the federal government has deemed the encryption is dangerous, and attempted to legally suppress it. In the case of browsers, and this is now going back 20 years, you know, we've had, by the way, we've had strong, unbreakable encryption for decades now. More than 20 years now, it's been out there. And the math is simple. Simple enough that it can be communicated literally on a T-shirt. I'll get to that in a second. The math that makes a message completely unbreakable, period, can be communicated on a T-shirt. It's that simple. And can be, you know, once you understand the principle, can be created infinitely by even a middle rank coder or crypto or mathematician. It's very simple, and it's out there. It's universal. However, back in the 90s, we thought, the federal government thought, oh, boy, you know, if other people got this, we'd never, you know, the Enigma machine. Remember that? The big fascinating story of the war of the North Atlantic. The Germans were just taking out shipping in the Atlantic like crazy, and they because they could communicate to, with their submarines, with their U-boats, securely using the Enigma machine. And the Allies worked very hard to get an Enigma machine. They finally got one. They still couldn't figure it out. Took a brilliant mathematician, in fact, in many ways, the father of modern computing, Alan Turing. And if you saw The Imitation Game, you know the story. Well, you know a version, a Hollywood version of the story that's completely wrong. But you know the gist of it, which is through his superior mental faculties and hard work and an early computer, he was able to crack the Enigma code. And we were able to end the German domination of shipping in the North Atlantic because of it. That's the power of strong encryption. It allows bad people to communicate. It also allows good people to communicate. So in the 90s, we thought we'd learned that lesson. We said, we cannot let this strong encryption get outside the U.S., which, by the way, was absurd. But so we're gonna classify it as munitions and say that it may not be exported. So an American company making a program, let's say Netscape browser as an example, cannot, in the United States, it can have good encryption. But if we're going to export it outside of the United States, it has to have weakened, intentionally, governmentally, legislatedly weakened encryption so that, you know, our enemies abroad can't use it. So Netscape and other U.S. companies complied. Yeah, okay. But by the way, if we're going to do that, we're going to sell it in the U.S. too, because we're not going to have, there's no way that we could sell a version in the United States that is not available in Latvia. It's just, I mean, it's electronic, it's bits, it's digits, it's, you know. So they say, okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to make all the browsers use 40-bit encryption, crackable encryption. And here we are 20 years later, by the way, and it's a huge vulnerability because we continue to have to support that for people using old browsers on websites. And we're only now finally getting that weakened code out of these websites so we can actually have safe shopping online. We're only now, 20 years later, getting it out of the code. The government, in effect, mandated weakened encryption. And as a result, we've suffered 20 years of insecurity because of it. Oh, and by the way, did it stop encryption from getting out of the United States? Not at all. Not at all. In fact, a guy printed on the code, printed it on a T-shirt. It's just a few lines. And crossed the border outside the U.S. He exported it. And what are they going to do? It's a T-shirt. There's nothing they could do. So the truth is now, worldwide, everyone, and you don't have to be very sophisticated to understand it. I could explain it to you. Everyone understands how to make strong encryption, unbreakable encryption. It's known. It's math. The math is out there. So President Obama can rant and rail all he wants and can even, if he pays no attention to the history of the United States and encryption, even mandate that Apple and others make weakened encryption in their smartphones. And Apple might have to. If he gets Congress and the courts to agree, Apple will have to. What will happen? You and I will suffer from weakened encryption for another 20 years, while the bad guys, no problem. Because it's out there. It's out there. They can do it. 70 different countries. This is a study, U.S. federal government study, from the Department of Defense, I think, Defense Intelligence Agency. 70 different countries offer strong encryption, unbreakable encryption products. 70 different countries. Maybe they pass a law in all 70 countries. Then country 71 will make it. I could make it. I can write it on a T-shirt. You can't legislate against something that can be written in four lines of code. You can't stop it. It exists. So the only thing, you really have to understand this, and apparently politicians don't, because they're, you know, excellent at the art of negotiation and compromise, but you can't compromise and negotiate with math. 2 + 2 always equals 4. You can't say it equals 5 or 3. You can't say it's 4-ish. It's 4. It's 4. You can't legislate against it. And that's what, in effect, they're saying, well, we're going to make Apple have 2 + 2 = 5, and every company in the United States can make 2 + 2 = 5. Too bad. So what? So sad. It doesn't. And it won't. And it never will. The only effort, and I'm sure they're making this effort, that the federal government can make right now, law enforcement, probably not sophisticated enough to do it, but maybe the big spy agencies, is create faster and faster computers. Because the reason the math works is because it's a very hard problem. And if computers were fast enough, they could solve them faster. Right now, I can make a password, an encryption password, that would take trillions of years to brute force, to unencrypt. That's not hard. But if computers get faster, maybe it'll only take 1 million years, and maybe then only 100,000 years, and maybe someday only 100 years. Still not fast enough. We got to get it down to days, right, or minutes. And we got a long way to go. And by then, I would bet that the math will come up with another way. Math's good at this. That is even harder to solve. You know, one way to make it a harder problem to solve is to use more bits. Remember, 40-bit encryption, the thing that they mandated, they required for export, that's so few bits that you can solve it in a matter of days. And as computing got faster, you could solve it faster and faster. But, you know, you take 40 bits and you make it 128 bits, well, it's a lot harder to solve. Not 30 times harder to solve. It's trillions of times harder to solve. And you make it 256 bits, it's even harder. So you make it 512 bits or 1024 or 2048. In fact, my PGP key, the key I use to encrypt my email, which the government would also like to, I'm sure, outlaw, I use 2048 bits of encryption. That's impossible in modern technology to crack. So I'm sorry to belabor this, but I don't understand why the president of the United States doesn't understand something that a 12-year-old gets. It's math, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Okay, Archandra, look out for quantum computing in a few decades. So you know what quantum computing has done to date? It's factored the number 15. That's Scott Wilkinson singing along. Scott is our home theater guru and a singer, so it's okay. We'll allow that.
It's okay. Thank you.
We'll give you a pass. He is the host of the Home Theater Geeks podcast on the Twit Network, which is my network, disclaimer, twit.tv/HTG. That's because I love Scott so much and the information he gives us. He also is editor-in-chief at the AVS Forum and joins us each week to talk about home theater. What's up? Anything exciting in your world?
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I don't know, you might remember last week we were talking about 4K TV, UHD, and broadcasting. And I said, that's a couple of years away. And what I meant very specifically about that was terrestrial over-the-air broadcasting. Well, wouldn't you know it, this week I posted a story on AVS because I just learned that DirecTV, which is not over-the-air terrestrial broadcasting, it's satellite broadcasting, will do its first 4K broadcast of the Masters Tournament, the big golf classic in Augusta at the Augusta National Golf Club on April 7th through 10th. It's their first 4K broadcast.
How much compression they're going to put on that 4K to get it over the satellite?
You know what? I in doing research for the post that I did, I contacted DirecTV, and I said, what codec are you using? That is, what compression
They don't
scheme?
Have a choice, by the way. That's all built
they
into
have
the
to
satellite.
Do yeah, exactly. They have to, and they're doing HEVC, which is the latest version
well, that's
of
good,
codec.
Right? But it's not good, just the technology used to compress. It's the bit stream.
I said, what is your bit rate?
Yeah.
And he said, we can't reveal
yeah,
that.
Of course not, because I'll tell you why. you can guess.
Yeah, you can guess.
It's the same thing as Netflix doing 4K or YouTube doing 4K. And I really wish they wouldn't do it because it gives people the wrong impression of what 4K is.
Yes.
It's technically 4 4K bits on the screen, resolution of on the screen.
It's actually 8 million pixels on the screen.
Yeah, it's 8 megapixels. But if I gave you an 8 megapixel image that was compressed to 10% of its quality, you would look at it and go, "Oh, that doesn't look so good." In fact, and that's the problem. And I don't. I think what happens is people look at 4K on YouTube or Netflix or soon to be on DirecTV, and they go, "Well, what's the big deal?"
Well, and plus the fact that it's not going to be high dynamic range. We know this because that would require more bit rate, more bandwidth, and their specs say you need a TV with HDMI 2.0 and this copy protection called HDCP 2.2. But if they were going to be transmitting high dynamic range, you would need a TV with HDMI 2.0A, which would carry the metadata of
and
the
of course, no DirecTV box has that right now, I presume.
No.
Do they have 2.0?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they do. And they have 4K. They're their latest Genie HD DVR can actually receive and record on the hard drive, on the DVR, 4K content.
But I think it's really important for people to understand that you can say it's 4,096 by 2160 screen resolution.
3840 by 2160.
Okay. But if you're compressing the heck out of it, which you have to because the satellite has limited bandwidth, to be honest.
That's right.
And
that's
a cable company could do it, but they would have to take over several channels.
Well, now here's another piece of news that I just got after I got an email from Steve Erickson in Canada who says that the Canadian version of ESPN, which is called TSN, has now started broadcasting in 4K. Some of the hockey games, I guess, that are in Canada. And it's being carried on a couple of, let's see, oh, my computer just seemed to have died. It's carried on a couple of cable providers in Canada. Bell, I think, is one of them. And Rogers.
We learned this back when 1080p when HD arrived and Blu-rays started to come out with HD, and there was a wide variety of range of quality in these, and it's somewhat of a different story, but it was essentially if a bad master is not going to make a beautiful movie.
That's
you
right.
really have to take some care, and it takes a while to learn that.
Yes.
It's unfortunate because a lot of people are buying TVs, and if you buy a TV today, it's going to be a 4K TV, which aren't great. They're not great TVs, and then they're going to be streaming content from these highly compressed 4K sources, and they're not going to look good, and they're going to go, well, what's that all about?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily
or maybe they don't know the difference. Maybe it's like there's a huge placebo effect. They might say, wow, look at my beautiful screen.
Yeah. You said that the 4K TVs you can get today aren't that great. Many of them are that great. Many of them are fabulous. So it's not that the TV isn't good. It's I agree with you entirely that the content coming in is often not very good. The highly compressed streams, this highly compressed satellite signal. I don't know what these cable companies are doing, but they're probably pretty highly compressed. The best UHD or 4K content you can get today is UHD Blu-ray. And just like we saw with Blu-ray when it first came out in the early 2000s.
The same problem's going to happen, right? Poor masters.
The same problem is having.
Yeah.
So, they are having the same problem. Yeah. Some of the titles that are coming out are great, and some are not so great.
Well, the other problem is there's how many titles? 20?
Well, maybe 15 or 20 at this point. Not very many. But
so
hey,
you don't have a lot of choice either.
It's only been, a few weeks since they first came out. So, I got to cut them a little slack for that.
Well, no, I agree. I'm not blaming them, but I'm just saying it's going to take a while before the movie you want is available in UHD.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I liken this to the emergence, the early days of multi-channel music, which there isn't very much multi-channel music even today. But in the early days, when we first had surround sound systems and studios came out with albums of multi-channel music and stuff, and we listened to it at demos, it was terrible. The mixing was just awful. There was this cowbell clanking at me from the right rear surround. And that was, I think, because the mixers, the engineers, didn't have a lot of experience with it. And so they needed to get some experience. And I think the same thing is happening now with Ultra HD and in particular high dynamic range. I've been hearing stories that some of these titles, these Ultra HD Blu-ray titles, the black levels really aren't that deep. And with high dynamic range, it's supposed to be really, really deep. But it's inconsistent. And that, again, I think is just a matter of these people don't have a lot of experience actually creating the content for the home market for the UHD Blu-ray, and that it's going to improve as time goes on.
Good, good, yeah.
I have no doubt of that.
So don't, I would say don't rush to, oh my gosh, well, I got to get DirecTV now and a UHD, you know, premium TV set.
Yeah, not only do you have to have the 4K TV and the high-end Genie DVR, you also have to be subscribed to one of their two top packages.
You know what we never talk about? Package. And somebody in the chat room is pointing this out. The actual content itself. this is in the early days of hi-fis. Remember, nobody. It wasn't really about the picking the music you wanted. It was about the music that showed off your hi-fi. Yes. Everybody listened to the 1812 Overture because it had bells and cannons.
Right.
Even if you didn't like it, who doesn't like the 1812 Overture? But, but that's the point, is that at this point, we're still in that era where you're looking at specs, not content so much.
Yes. And somebody in the chat room asked me, well, what Ultra HD Blu-ray would you buy now, even if you had the Blu-ray of it? And I said, well, there aren't much choice.
What are the movies? What are the movies we can watch?
Well, let's see. There's Hitman 74. Hitman.
I didn't want to see that in the theater.
Yeah, Smurfs 2. Believe it or not, it's the best. It's the best HDR title out there.
Scott Wilkinson.
People are going to buy that.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls. More. We're going to take your calls next. Hitman 47.
That's it.
What is that?
It's actually not Hitman 40. It's Hitman something 47. Agent 47. That's what it is.
I never even heard of that.
Yeah, I'm told it's a very good transfer. A very good.
Oh, wonderful. A movie you don't want to see in perfect transfer.
Well, how about Smurfs 2, for God's sake? I sure don't want to see that.
You know, after.
Everybody tells me it's the absolute best looking.
After Smurfs 1, I just don't know if I can handle it. After what they did to the Smurfs in Smurfs 1, I'm just not ready for the Smurfs 2.
I know.
No spoilers, please.
Papa Smurf, it's just sad what happened to him.
Hey, Heather Hammond, how are you?
Hey, Scott. Papa Smurf really let himself go. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah.
We have a TV-esque call if you guys want to do it on 4.
All right. I feel like we should get to some actual calls, but let's see here. Okay. Well, yeah, we can do that. Yeah. We'll do that when we come back.
What is the question?
He wants to know whether you should get a Samsung or a Vizio smart TV.
Ah, okay. By the way, in the meantime, Chumley is asking, is 4K and UHD the same thing? And the answer is technically no. They are not the same thing. But those two terms are so conflated.
Well, and the number that I gave you, the resolution I gave you, was technically 4K.
True 4K.
But not UHD, which is a little bit lower resolution in the horizontal.
Correct. UHD is otherwise known as quad HD. So it's exactly four times the number of pixels of HD. And another way to think of that is twice the number of pixels vertically and twice the number horizontally. So whereas HD is 1920 by 1080, you multiply each of those numbers by 2 and you get 3840 by 2160, which is otherwise known as quad HD or UHD. But the manufacturers and so many other people just use the term 4K for that, even though 4K is 4096 across by 2160 down. And that is the digital cinema standard. And so technically they are not the same, but they are used as the same. They're used interchangeably more often than not, and that really bugs me. Battlecam says Hitman Agent 47 is basically a bootleg James Bond movie. Well, that may be. Leo's entirely right that here in the very early days, you know, we'll take whatever we can get, and they're not always putting out the very best content. And I'm not quite sure why. I asked Don Eklund that question on this week's podcast, just last Thursday, And I don't recall him having a really good answer for that. He works for Sony. And Sony, generally, the four or five Sony titles that are out, Sony plus Columbia, which is part of the Sony Pictures family, they have generally been considered the best Ultra HD Blu-rays out there so far. SW40s, yeah, exactly. Ultra High Definition Television, also known as 2160p. That would be a better way to say it, because we have 1080p, we have 720p, we should have 2160p, but no, people call it 4K, referring to the horizontal resolution rather than what consumer products have typically referred to as the vertical resolution. Okay, we're not quite there yet, but I have 30 seconds left. So Lawn Dog asked, which format has potential for better picture, 4K or UHD? The difference is minimal, so I don't think one has... You know, I mean, a few extra pixels in 4K in the movie theater, which has a 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 foot wide screen.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, asked, Leo, I have been remiss. It is a call-in show, I know, and I'm sorry. I've been giving you the phone number, but I haven't been answering the phone. So Heather Hammond, who has been, is probably mad at me right about now. She's been keeping the poor callers just happy. Rotating through. It's okay. It's okay. Yeah. It's okay. Leo's going to get to you. So who should I start with?
Did you want to do Paul? With
yeah, let's do
question.
Paul, because yeah, he's got and I think Scott's still in the neighborhood.
Scott's still around?
Here
yeah.
I is.
Yeah. Paul and Tarzana, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Leo. Hello, Scott.
Hey, how you doing, Paul?
Question. Good. I'm looking to buy a 32-inch smart TV, and I'm looking at the Vizio and the Samsung. And I'd like to know your preferences, and are there differences between the audio and the video?
So you're not asking about the smart TV features. You're talking about the TV as a whole.
Correct.
Yeah, because I got to tell you, as far as I'm concerned, and I own both Samsung and Vizio smart TVs, Vizio has the best software of the two. Samsung software is just awful.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
But you ought to know about audio quality and things like that, huh?
Yeah.
Boy, on a 32 inch TV, yeah, exactly.
That's my impression.
It's not going to be great in either way.
None of these TVs put a lot of thought into the audio, because they figure, hey, you're probably going to have your own speakers.
Yeah, exactly. But if you don't, I mean, a 32-inch TV, I would assume is more like a second bedroom TV or something like that. It's not your main TV, or is it?
Well, it's going to be the main TV.
It's going to be the main TV.
Is this your first HD TV, Paul?
No.
Okay.
No.
So, one of the things that happens when people move to HD, flat panels from tube TVs, a tube TV 32 inches is massive.
Yeah.
Because of the tube.
Yep.
On a flat panel, it's tiny. Dancy. Yeah,
exactly. And you're not going to use external speakers with it.
No.
Or a sound bar or something like that.
No, this is just going to be a very basic TV, low in price from a big box store.
The good news is that you can get a 32 or even a 40 for a few hundred bucks now. They're very, very affordable.
Well, if this is going to be your main TV, one piece of advice I would give is, can you fit anything larger? I would also ask how far you're sitting from it.
Probably maybe 5 feet, 6 feet.
Oh, okay. So not too bad. That's pretty close.
Right.
Can you go up to a 40 or a 42?
Possibly.
You might be surprised when you look at it. They're not much more expensive.
No.
When you go over 42 is when the price jump happens.
Okay.
Right. But up to 42... And if you get something 42 as opposed to 32, it's going to be a big difference in your perceived immersion, shall I say. Now, which one is better? Boy, they're both really good. So
Vizio has three kind of levels. They have the E series, which is their least expensive, right?
There's also the D series.
D is even less expensive, and then there's.
Then there's E, and then there's M,
which
which is kind of the middle of the road, which is what I recommend generally.
And then there's the P, which you can't get because it's not available.
The P probably. Oh no! And I don't think they make it that small.
Yeah, no, they don't. It's giant.
And then there's the reference series, right, which is another can of worms altogether.
So if you can afford an M, that's a good one.
That's a good one.
But I think with Vizio, even the D's and E's are actually surprisingly good.
Actually very good. Yeah. I agree with you entirely.
I would probably go with that. If budget is a concern,
I would too.
You're going to get more bang for your buck out of Vizio.
Plus the fact that Samsung TVs have a they have a reputation for having pretty bad sound.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mainly because the speakers, and I don't know about this year's models, but in the past, the speakers were on the back of the TV, pointing backwards.
Which is crazy.
It is crazy, but there's no room on the front if you want a thin, super thin little bezel. I must admit, I don't remember where the Vizio speakers are.
They're on the front, at least the ones I bought. I don't know about the most recent models, but the ones I bought. And they're decent sound. I've used the Vizio speakers alone. In fact, my guest room has a Vizio TV, which is actually doubles as my daughter's room. She watches it, and it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah. And Vizio makes pretty good sound bars as well, so you'd think that they would do a good job of the sound in their TVs, as good as you can in that terribly limited space.
Right. Hey, thanks for the call. I appreciate it, Paul. Go shopping.
Yeah.
It's a good day to do it. And thanks to you, Scott Wilkinson, avsforum.com, and, of course, Home Theater Geeks podcast at twit.tv/HTG. Gary, Los Angeles, taking advantage of Scott and his – we're going to have to pay you overtime today, Scott. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Leo. Hi, Scott.
Welcome.
Hey, Gary.
Hey, listen, here's a simple, easy question. I know you'll have the answer right away. As I understand it, in order for a television such as the new LG Signature G6 series to obtain from a Samsung 4K Blu-ray player, it has to have HDMI 2.0A in order for it to receive HDR10 material.
Wow, you got that exactly right.
Yeah, the latest and greatest. Correct. Yeah.
But for Dolby Vision, I think it just requires 2.0, but not A. Is that correct?
That is correct. You have that exactly correct. And the reason
yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, so I want to. I'm looking at two TVs: the LG G6 65 inch versus the Vizio Reference Series. And I understand that the Vizio Reference Series does not have a 2.0A input.
That's because it's last year's TV, huh?
You got it exactly correct.
Not to mention the fact that you could go to the Vizio site and they'll say back ordered. I don't know how many.
That's also true.
Yeah.
That is also true. The Vizio Reference Series has 2.0, not 2.0A, which means that it can only receive Dolby Vision high dynamic range, not HDR10, which is the other main form. It's a colloquial term for that, which is the only type of HDR coming from the Samsung Blu-ray player. I absolutely strongly recommend the LG for that reason, that it will do both HDR10 from a Samsung Blu-ray player, Ultra HD Blu-ray player, and Dolby Vision from, say, Vudu and a few other sources. You have the most flexibility with the LG OLED. And if you got the money, well, you've got the money because the Reference Series 65 inch is very expensive.
Right.
It's on the $6,000 range or something like that. And the G6 OLED?
Yeah, that's like $7,000.
Yeah, yeah.
But boy,
so it's more.
That's the one I want. That's, if I had a choice, that's the one I'd be buying.
No question. Me too.
Now, do you know whether the going to 2.0A, is that a firmware upgrade? Can Vizio change that?
No. I'm pretty sure that's a hardware upgrade.
Oh, interesting.
Connector?
Yeah.
Yep. Well, the connector's the same. The connector's the same, but the chips behind the connector.
So it is a hardware difference that you can't change
in software.
Yeah. Thank you for the call. Great questions, Gary. Thank you, Scott, for hanging in there.
We're gonna
get back to technology. I got calls next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Da-da-da-da. Yeah. You want to stick around for a little bit, Scotty? Yeah, go. It's all yours,
Boy,
my friend.
That guy really had it down. He knew. He He knew the answers to those questions. That was great. So, yeah. Hey, everybody. Good to see you all here on this fine Saturday. It's not raining here in L.A. at the moment. It did yesterday pretty steadily. But kind of quick. It kind of came and went. By the evening, it wasn't here anymore. Now it looks pretty good, at least what I can see out the window. So, yeah, anybody got any questions here? Let's see. UJ, is it possible for the studios to remaster visual effects to 4K for future UHD Blu-ray mastering? Great question. This brings up a pretty, what I call a dirty little secret of UHD Blu-ray, which is that even if they shot the movie at 4K, say on a Red camera or a Sony digital cinema camera, something like that, where they got 4K or better resolution, all of the CGI is almost always done at 2K. And the reason is that the computers required to do all that CGI rendering take so much longer, twice as long, to do 4K rendering as they do 2K. And the studios don't think they have the time or the money to do it. So they do it in 2K and then they upscale it to 4K. And in many cases, the movie is shot in 2K, even the live action, if there is any. And then the whole thing is upscaled to 4K for the Blu-ray. That is very often what happens. Not always, but often. And we often don't know what happened there. And so we have to trust the quality of their upscalers, the studio's upscalers, which are probably pretty good. They're using professional equipment. But again, as I said earlier, we're in the early days of this. And so even the equipment may be prototype or, you know, version 1.0 or something. So, you know, it'll improve over time. I have no doubt of that whatsoever. But the CGI is still mostly, for the most part, 2K. M. Heiss. Oh, Mike. Hey, how you doing, Mike? You're told that in some cases they can upgrade from 2.0 to 2.0A, but not from 1.4 to 2.0. That is absolutely true. You can't go from 1.4 to 2.0 with a software or firmware upgrade. That is a hardware upgrade. I was under the impression that 2.0 to 2.0A was also a hardware upgrade. Now you've put doubt in my mind, damn you. So I'll have to do some research into that and see if that's really true. That was my impression from what I have seen so far. But let's see. Do I charge by the minute or by the call, key 43? No, this... I'm just hanging on a Saturday. Let's see. SW40s. I have not spoken to, well, I've spoken to some encoding experts, and I imagine I'll speak to more at NAB next month. You've sent me a link to video coding from the BBC, so that's good. How close should you, user 8214, how close should you sit to watching a 55-inch TV? I don't want to see pixels or blurriness. Good for you. I wouldn't either. A 55-inch TV, you probably, well, HD, high definition, for high definition, the general rule is 3 times the screen height. And unfortunately, screen sizes are specified in the world in diagonal. So you have to do a little math to figure out what the screen height is. But generally speaking, you want to be about 8 feet away from a 70-inch TV, which seems awfully close for a screen that size. But for a 55-inch, you'd want to be less than 8 feet, you know, maybe 6 feet or so. I'd have to do the math, and I'm not going to just jump into that right this minute. But that's for HD. For UHD, in order to still not see pixels or blurriness, you need to sit twice as half the distance as for HD, 1.5 times the screen height. So that is impractical. Most people aren't going to do that because you're sitting there really close to the TV. And the TV is filling much more of your field of view, which is what they want, what the people who have designed the system expect, because they want it to be more immersive. But I say sitting that close to a TV is impractical in most cases. So people are going to sit back at the HD distance more than the UHD ideal distance. So if you do that, if you sit at the HD distance, you're not going to see pixels. You're not going to see blurriness. The picture's going to look quite good. There are those who say that sitting at that distance with UHD, you can really see the improvement in detail. Well, if you've got that kind of visual acuity, good for you. Go for it. The more important thing at that distance, in my opinion, is high dynamic range. Once that becomes well established, that you can see the improvement, and it's a big improvement at any distance. It doesn't matter. You could be across the room. It could look like a postage stamp, and you'd still see a big improvement in the picture. So that is the general answer to that question. Let's see here. Depends on which chip vendor. Ah, that's a pretty good idea, M. Heiss, Mike. The other thing that I just learned recently was that LG, in their 2015 EG9600 series, was only able to do HDR from its internal apps, which means that it only had HDMI 2.0. And they did a running change, what they call a running change, late in 2015 to allow it to accept HDR from an external source, like an Ultra HD Blu-ray player, which means they had to upgrade to 2.0A. And in that case, at least, it was, in fact, a hardware update that the TVs manufactured after a certain date in, I think, December, the EG9600s, would had a hardware update that then allowed them to accept HDR from an external source. So that's an example of requiring a hardware update. But you're right, Mike. It could be depending on the chip vendor. Some HDMI 2.0 transceiver chips might have the capability of doing the metadata with a firmware update, but others won't. In the case of LG, it didn't. Lawn Dog says it's possible that some manufacturers do not put in the features for upgrading firmware because it probably is an added expense to the cost of the TV. That may very well be. And Battlecam says Roku has said that their new 4K box is only HDMI 2.0, could be upgraded to HDMI 2.0A with a firmware update. So maybe they worked with a chip manufacturer, a chip vendor, that did allow the upgrade by software, and they decided to spend the extra money because that chip's probably more expensive in order to be more future-proof.
Thank you, Scott. Have a great week.
My pleasure. You too.
All right. And see you next week.
See ya.
All right.
You bet.
Well, hey. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. That concludes our crypto and home theater hour. Now we're going to get back to the calls. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number if you want to talk about anything in tech. I cover the waterfront. In fact, when I first started doing this in 1992, it was really pretty much limited to computers, right? Then we added the internet and then smartphones. I mean, there's been a lot of new stuff since then. They say, this is my weight lifting regime. If you start lifting a baby cow over your head when it's born, and then you continue to lift it as the cow grows, eventually you'll be able to lift a full-size adult cow. I think they're wrong, but they say that. And I feel like that's kind of what I've been doing since 1992 with the computer industry. It's, when it was started, it was just a little thing. Now it's gotten to be somewhat larger than it was. But through constant application of effort, I've managed, and a lot of help from you, the listeners in our chat room, I've managed to kind of keep up with the business. Back to the phones. Roy in Fresno, California. Hi, Roy. Leo Laporte.
Hi, Leo.
Hi.
Good talking to you. I have listened to you for years, and I finally have a question I want to ask of
you. Yay.
I have been experimenting for the last couple weeks with Linux and
yes.
Linux Mint. But being a Windows guy for 20 years, I have one program that I want to run, a Windows program that will access the internet with
Perfect.
Wine.
Oh, yeah, Wine. Okay, good.
go through all these forums, and all these guys are saying, don't use wine. Don't use wine with the Internet.
No. That's bogus. Issue. That's bogus. The only real issue is, does that program run with wine? Because wine is not an emulator. In fact, that's what wine stands for. Wine is not an emulator.
Right.
What it does is it duplicates as best it can, and it's an open source project, and a lot of people put a lot of effort into it, but it duplicates as best it can the Windows programming interface. Uh-huh. So that a Windows, you can often, but not always, run a program designed for Windows on Linux using Wine, because the program, you know, for instance, when you write a program that's designed for Windows, you make a call to the Windows operating system to draw Windows. You don't draw the window yourself. You call the operating system. You say, hey, operating system, draw a window here of such and such design. Now, if you do that on Linux, Linux is going to go, huh, what? I don't know what that means. But if you do it under Wine with Wine's help, Wine will say, oh, I know what you mean, and translate for Linux. It's kind of like almost like a little translator. But it's very limited in, not very, but it's actually surprisingly good at the variety of Windows programs it'll run. But it doesn't run all programs because it's not Windows.
Right.
So, have you tried your program in it?
I have just tried the program. I haven't accessed the Internet. This program is called Calendar Scope. It's a calendar that will then sync with Google Calendar. It uses another little program called Handy Sync to sync with Google Calendar.
So it may or may not work. Wine tends to work best with large, popular programs like Microsoft Word. Because the Wine developers make all the changes needed to make Word work. Now, your question is it safe?
Right.
Well, that should answer your question. In general, it is, because you're not running Windows. So a virus which expects a Windows environment is going to go, I don't know. In fact, you wouldn't want to use Wine for a browser. You have perfectly good browsers, including Google Chrome on Linux.
Right.
So just use the Linux versions. The virus isn't going to even be able to get in. How is using Microsoft Word going to let a virus get in?
That's what I thought. You know, I posted a question on the forum. All these guys were saying, well, it can happen.
It could in theory. It's highly unlikely.
I said, has anybody ever got it?
No.
And no one person knew somebody.
Oh, come on. Bad guy would have, first of all, you'd have to use a program under Wine that accessed the Internet or accessed files downloaded from the Internet. Second, so let's say, for instance, here's a common exploit. You're a bad guy. I'll talk like this as bad guy, because bad guy often come from Eastern Europe. Bad guy goes out and buys special kit of, they call them exploits, and then looks for websites that have been hacked or are hackable. They haven't kept their site up to date, just like you're supposed to keep your operating system up date. They didn't do that with a website. Oh, look, I found a website that has a very big vulnerability. I put hacking kit on the website. Now, the website continues to operate. And you go as, an innocent user. You go, Roy, I'm going to my website. You go to the website. And the website then kicks in with this hacking kit looking for flaws in Windows. Mm. You're not running Windows. You're running Linux.
I see. Right.
So it doesn't see any flaws. But let's say maybe you were dumb enough to be using, this would be dumb, Internet Explorer in Wine on Linux. Well, if there were a flaw in Internet Explorer, it might see that flaw and then say, oh, good, I found Internet Explorer 8. Who still uses that? And he applies the flaw. But the problem is the flaw is not written just for Internet Explorer 8. It's written for Internet Explorer 8 on Windows. So unless this bad guy, is really going to say, I want to get Wine users. I want to go after Linux Wine users. He's not going to be able to take advantage of it. This is highly unlikely.
Very cool. That's what I thought.
It's a good way to do it. It's safe.
I kind of knew you'd know the answer.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Wine's great. It's amazing that it works. It doesn't work 100%. And what you may find is that you can run the program, it sort of works, and then a few things don't work. Because if you think about it, somebody has to write all the routines that particular program wants to use and make them work on Linux Mint. Alan in Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Leo. Actually, my sister is having a little problem with her phone. Her contacts, she's trying to save them to Google.
Okay.
And she's she's got them in groups. And when she saves them over to Google Cloud, they go away. They're not in the phone. They're not on Google.
Hmm. So in other words, the phone is not synchronizing properly with Google.
It's not synchronizing hardly at all. As a matter of fact, the last time she was able to synchronize was February 6th.
What kind of phone, Android or iOS?
It's an Android.
Okay.
It's a Kyocera Hydrolife.
What version of Android is it? Do you know?
4.3.
Yeah, pretty old. Okay.
You can get the thing there.
Yeah.
So
it's an old version of Android. That could be the problem, but most likely it's a settings issue. Make sure she's logged in to the proper Google account on the phone. You know, when you first get any Android phone, one of the very first things it does is say, okay, connect it to your Google account. And that's the one it'll synchronize calendars with. And then the other issue is go into whatever, or contacts in this case, go into the contacts program. And this may be the problem. A lot of times, this kind of bugs me. Companies that make smartphones make their own calendar in addition to the Google calendar. So there's a Google calendar. In fact, you can get that on the Google Play Store. In fact, I think this would be the fix for it. But I noticed this with Samsung. I love the Samsung Galaxy S7. It's just like the most amazing, beautiful, wonderful phone. But Samsung continues, for some reason, to put its own browser, its own calendar, its own voice. You know, Google makes the best in class in those, in all those categories. There's no reason in Android not to use the Google apps. Well, except for branding, I guess. So my guess is Kyocera's got its own funky calendar or contacts app on there. Problem is the contacts is tied to the dialer. So you're going to have to look in the settings on the contacts app, make sure that it's synchronizing with Google and it's synchronizing with all the groups. You see, that may be the problem. Same thing happens with calendars sometimes. It doesn't get all the calendars. And if not, I'm pretty sure now that you can get the Google dialer on the Play Store. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I have to look. Can you get the Google calendar on the Play Store? If not, get a different calendar, but not the Kyocera calendar would be. Let's just see. We'll go real quickly here. Apps. And Google Calendar. Oh, not calendar. See, I keep saying calendar. It's contacts. No. Yeah. So I would... Okay, so there's the good news. You get the Google Contacts app and use that. Because that will for sure work. And then that should synchronize up with the contacts on the Kyocera. So this is the problem when company. I don't wish they wouldn't do this. They for some reason they just say, "Oh, you don't want to use that silly Google contacts. You want to use our special super duper Kyocera contacts, which we haven't updated in 4 years." Somebody said, "Leo, you should stop punishing yourself with your diet. You should have something nice to eat." You're right. That's why it's Nature Box time. Actually, I love eating healthy foods, and that's one of the reasons we love Nature Box snacks, because they come, they're delivered to you, and they're just wonderful stuff with no artificial flavors or sweeteners, no high fructose corn syrup, no trans fats. Nutritionist designed, and they have hundreds of flavors, so you're always going to get something interesting. Let's see what's in the Nature Box this week. We got the apple pie oat clusters. It's raisins, brown rice, syrup, sugar, oats, almonds, coconut, malted wheat flakes. Oh, this sounds fabulous. Fabulous. Mini Belgian waffles. Look, you could go back and eat a stale candy bar from the candy machine, or you could get Nature Box delivered to your door, and we're going to get you half off your first Nature Box. Heather's going, gimme, gimme, gimme. How about, this is the one. I think when Sarah left, She went to TechCrunch. She actually took all of these with her. Strawberry Greek yogurt pretzels. She couldn't stop eating those. They're so good. Oh, look at this. Probiotic power mix. Probiotic fruit and nut mix. It's got cranberries, Greek yogurt, apricots. Wow. This looks really good. This is for your ooh, they have some big bags, too. Cranberry pepita crisps. Look, go to naturebox.com. Browse around. You get sweet, savory, spicy. They have snacks that are vegan if you want. Not all of them, but you can choose gluten-free, you know, variety of dietary needs. And they're all uniformly fabulous. Naturebox.com/twit. Get 50% off your first box right now. Cranberry and pumpkin seed pita crisps. This sounds really good. I think I probably should do the probiotic power mix. Naturebox. But it's fun to choose. Naturebox.com/twit. Browse around. See all the different snack flavors. There's always new ones, too, which is great. All right. I'm going to tell you what. We're going to give you a care package, Heather. You can just pick whichever one you want from my newest Nature Box. I get new ones all the time, you know. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK. Leo, that's the phone number, 888-827-5536. So I was looking, and Google does put its contacts app on the Google Play Store. They're doing that with more and more of the Google apps. So if you have a third-party contacts app on an Android device, maybe, and it's not working right, get the Google one. Google keeps that one up to date. And I would imagine that they will then use the contacts that the Google Contacts has for the dialer, because that's what you really want, right? Ruben in Downey, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Ruben.
How you doing, Leo?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, good. Yeah, my question was, I wanted to get my wife one of those Amazon Fires or whatever. They were selling out like crazy at Best
Yeah,
Buy.
They were so cheap. So they were selling them in six packs, and I think we bought 3 6 packs at the studio. Everybody wanted one. They were like $50 each.
Yeah, $50 each. But the thing is, is that good for anything? Like my wife.
Oh yeah.
Maybe do some maybe see the Bible or whatever. You know, do
absolutely
some Bible stuff like that.
So
how about for games?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not a powerhouse processor, so games that are very demanding may not run super fast. But most games that you would download on an Android device of any kind are going to be pretty easy on the resources because they want it to work on all the phones or all the tablets.
You need a Wi-Fi, right?
You need Wi-Fi. Although, yeah, I don't know if they sell it with 3G. I don't think they do. I think you need Wi-Fi. No, I think those Fire tablets are a good deal. The reason they're such a good deal is Amazon doesn't have to make money on them because they make money when you buy books and stuff at the Amazon store. So it's just kind of like a storefront for them.
How about the next one up? Like, I think it's
you get better results. The screen is where you sacrifice. The less you pay, the worse the screen is. So, but the Kindle Fires are easily the most affordable and best inexpensive Android tablets out there.
They sold out so fast.
Yeah.
I couldn't even get one. I had to wait. Now they're like out of stock.
Yeah. So get the next one up. I still think they're pretty affordable, aren't they?
I think it's another $150.
Is it really? Is it like that? No wonder it's sold out.
And then the next one is like almost $200.
I'm looking at the Kindle Fire 7-inch display, Wi-Fi 8 gigs, $50, and it is in stock on Amazon. So don't, before the radio show goes, before, quick, go to Amazon. This one is on, now this is an 8-inch, but perfect for Bible study, for reading books of any kind. Really, this is what Amazon hopes you'll
do. Work. She does work for her, her nursing stuff, like she has to take tests and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right for it too?
It's got a full browser on it. Anything that'll work on a browser, it'll be fine. I think for $50, why not? I mean, that's a great deal for $50.
How about hacking ability? I mean, as far as, can somebody hack on those or,
you're going to hack your wife's Fire tablet?
No. I mean, what if she's doing some work and it's
later? Oh, you mean somebody hacks her?
Yeah.
Oh, no, don't. No. Mobile is very safe. You're fine. Nobody's going to hack your Fire.
Okay, great.
Much safer than a general computer. Much.
Awesome.
Yeah, highly recommend it. I have no problem with it. You just understand, for $50, you're only getting 8 gigs of storage. It's not a huge amount. Probably doesn't matter. Books are small. Bible. The whole Bible is a couple of megabytes. I mean, it's we're talking 8 gigabytes, 8,000 megabytes. You got lots of room. And the screen which is not bad, isn't the best available. It's $50. Go for it. You're going to love it, and your wife is going to love you. And I know that's the real motivation here, isn't it, after all? I just said it the other moment. I was talking to somebody. Happy wife, happy life. Dan in Beaumont. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. I have an HP TouchSmart 320 PC. It's kind of an older touchscreen computer.
Yeah.
And it's running Windows 7.
Right.
And since November, Windows did an update to Windows 7. And since then, I have not been able to get onto the internet.
What?
Yeah, it recognizes my Wi-Fi, but it won't get on the internet.
How frustrating is that?
Extremely.
And I'm surprised you've put up with it for 4 months.
Well, I've got another computer here, and I've been able to work around it, but... Yeah.
Well, that's not obviously that isn't what's supposed to happen.
No.
So something went wrong. Probably the safest thing to do, especially if you don't have a lot of data on the HP, is to just rebuild, do recovery and
I've done a system restore. Is that what you're talking about?
No. The problem with a restore is it's not. It doesn't fix all problems. So the restore did not fix it, huh?
No, system restore did not fix it.
Interesting. How far back did you go on the system restore?
I had a point October 28th.
Like a month earlier, and it still didn't fix. See, that would roll back any updates that you did. So that's interesting. It could be you got a bug on there. So I would do not a restore, but a recovery, which is to put it back to the way it was when you bought it. Do you have data on there? You'll lose any data that's on there. Do you have data on there you need to keep?
I've actually already backed it up.
Smart man. Good man. So yeah, doing that, and then, of course, you'll run Windows Update until it's done. So you get it right, because that's dangerous to not do that. So you want to immediately update. But if you go back to the way it was when you bought it, the internet should work. Now, if it doesn't, then it's not the update. It's not Windows. There's something wrong with the physical hardware. It might be out of warranty. In fact, I'm sure it is by now. So in that case, you can bring it to a repair shop. It might be an easy fix. So the question is, did the what you think, which is the Windows update, did that break it? Or was it a coincidence? It was actually something physically went wrong with it.
Okay.
Recovering the operating system, starting from scratch in the operating system, won't obviously fix hardware errors. It'll only fix software errors. But that's the first thing I'd do.
Great. Thank you.
Sure, Dan. Anytime. Abel in New York City, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Abel.
Hey there, Leo. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
First time listener, first time caller.
Oh, well, welcome.
Hey, thanks. This is rough, but I had a good
Don't be embarrassed. No one knows you. There's got to be more than one Abel in New York City.
Yeah, there are a couple.
Okay.
So there's this much older gentleman who a friend of mine pointed me at. He was having problems with his computer.
Oh, and you wanted to help him.
I did.
You're a nice guy.
Sure. I mean, he had a IBM ThinkPad.
Okay.
From 2007, running Windows XP Pro.
Yep.
And the first thing was the fan needed replacing, so I ordered a new one, installed it. No problem. Computer boots.
Yep.
And... I see, he sees the two accounts there, his own and the administrator account.
Yeah.
None of the passwords he has works.
Uh-oh. Hold on. We'll fix it.
Yeah.
This is fixable.
Oh, no, wait.
Well, hang on. I got to take a break. I'm sure there's more, but hang on. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, but wait, there's more. It gets worse. It could be Johnny Jett singing this one. He's been everywhere, man. Johnny Jett, our travel guru, joins us each week to talk about better travel through technology. Hello, Johnny.
Hello, Leo.
Where are you?
I'm home in L.A., but I took my dad to Vegas this week.
It's always an exception when Johnny's home. That's the funny thing. It's like that's his vacation, is staying home.
Exactly. But I'm getting ready to leave for a 10-day trip. So,
oh, good. Did Dad enjoy Vegas?
Oh, my God. Actually, the guy won money. Which,
what?
You know, I left him at the craps table. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning. I was like, I have to go to bed. And he was like, I'm not going to bed.
Bed? I'm in Vegas. How old's your dad? How old's your dad, for people who don't know?
87.
87 years old.
87.
And it's just a sweetheart.
So,
he's down there. Yeah. What does he play?
Craps.
That's fun. That's the fun game. Was he betting on somebody or was he rolling?
Both. Both. I mean, the guy's good. But anyway.
You can't be good at craps. It's a game of chance. There's no skill in craps.
I can't even figure it out.
Yeah, that's complicated. But that's what makes it fun.
We were at the Aria Hotel.
Oh, you like the Aria? I've walked through it. It looks beautiful.
Oh, I love it. It's a great spot.
One of the new hotels.
But anyway, I got a website and an app for you before I lose my time.
Okay.
So this one, you might even know more about it than I do. But have you heard of a website called My Permissions?
My Permissions?
My Permissions. It's also on Android and iOS, but it's a website. And you know, especially when you're into travel, you're always signing up to every kind of promotion. At least I am.
Yeah.
And you're always you're always logging into your Facebook or Twitter to give them access so you could, sign up for a contest or whatever. And next thing you know, all these people have, access to your accounts. So what these guys do is you just sign up, takes 2 minutes, and it shows you who has all your permissions, what they can control. And you can go, it takes literally 2 minutes, and you can say, revoke access to letting them, comment on your site, which none of them really do, or at least, revoke their access for, having all your information or contacting your friends list. So it's
now,
an
I'm guessing
site.
In order to use My Permissions, you have to give them permission to access all those accounts.
You do. But then
you can, by the way, I'm just going to point this out. What? You don't have to use this. You can go into each account and set the permissions. And if you trust them, okay. But you are giving them permission. I guess you could then turn it off after you're done.
Exactly. Yeah. But, a lot of these sites are difficult to find out who has permission what. So this makes it a lot easier, at least,
My permissions.
So anyway.
All right. And it's actually, I'm not saying I don't like it. I'm just saying there's a Chrome thing, and there's a Google thing, and there's an iOS thing.
All right.
What else you got?
Next, I got an app for people who are on the road that can't sleep. I don't know if it's because, they're jet lagged or if their hotel's too noisy, but it's called Beditations, like meditations, but with a B as in boy. So Beditations. Huh. It's only on iOS. And they have a bunch of apps. So they have a bunch of meditations that are free. They have also some that are 99 cents.
This is a hot category now, isn't it? Meditations, guided meditations.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. The one problem is it's a big file. It's 177 megabytes.
Well,
so you're
going to
need Wi-Fi. It does.
Yeah.
But, and you can also unlock all their meditations for $5, but you can just use the free ones. But it's so simple. All you do is set what you want before you go to sleep. You can also have it, do ambient rain noise when it's over, especially if you have a noisy hotel room.
You can
just access your alarm clock for when you want to wake up, and it gives you one for when you wake
up. So you have a meditation to go to sleep and a meditation to wake up.
I would just use it to go to sleep. But according to this thing, or their sales pitch is, just a few minutes of meditations at the beginning of and end of each day will put your brainwave pattern into an alpha state.
Is what they say.
And your mind will become fresh, clear, and strong.
Very nice. And that is a
free. But I've been to so many hotels that are crazy.
I know. In fact, we're going to New York City in a couple of weeks. I bet it'll be noisy. I'm going to bring meditations with me. free to download, $4.99 if you want to buy all of the in-app purchases all at once. There, then they have different meditations, 99 cents each, but you might as well just get them all. For Johnny sure. Jett.
And you, I got a tip for
– go ahead.
Do I have time for a tip?
You do.
You know, the spring break's coming up next week, and the TSA has been sending out media alerts to everybody to let people know that show up to the airport extra early because they've been getting crushed. I've heard about wait times over an hour. If you have TSA PreCheck, you don't have to worry about it. But if you don't, you better show up to the airport extra early. They're recommending 2.5 to 3 hours early. And because the planes are not going to wait for you if that line's long. So
wow. You know,
it's better to be safe than sorry. So show up early.
When does it begin? When is spring break?
Spring break starting next week. I mean, some of them might even be on spring break
so
right now.
So stay away from New Orleans. Where is the big spring break in Florida?
What?
Stay away from
Panama City.
Stay away from
Fort Lauderdale.
Unless you like crazy drunk college kids, I would stay away from Fort Lauderdale.
It's not only that. It's all the families are traveling. You know, right. They could be going to different family.
We're traveling. That's why we're going to New York in 2 weeks. It's spring break. Oh yeah, yeah. I didn't think of this.
They say one of the worst airports is Minnesota right now. MSP. Minneapolis, and that those wait times have been over an hour.
Whoa.
So, you know, and no one's going to Minneapolis for spring break.
Wow. All right. So we're going to get to the airport early for our spring break. That's good advice.
But hopefully you have TSA PreCheck. Do you have TSA PreCheck?
No. Please. I know. You've told me. I want to get global entry because that's even better.
Global entry.
But I have to then go to some place that I'm never near. Yes. And get interviewed by the global entry security goons.
$100 for 5 years. It gives you TSA PreCheck included, which is normally $85 for 5 years. But if you travel internationally, get global entry.
Yeah.
If you're just going to travel domestically, then you can just sign up for TSA
should do it. And then I could just speed through those lines.
And get your family signed.
I have to go to Sacramento for an interview or somewhere. Some weird airport that I'm never at.
No. You can go. You should be able to go to SFO.
All right. Global entry. All right. Putting that on my to-do list. Johnny Jett, this is on your to-do list. Go to johnnyjett.com. Sign up for his free travel newsletters, plural. He's got many. But also follow him on Twitter, also at Johnny Jett. And he's on Instagram, great pictures. And we don't know. He won't tell us. He never says where he's going next. But if you follow him, all of a sudden you'll get a flood of interesting pictures from new places all around the world.
Well, thank you. And there's some great deals out there. Fiji's half off right now. I just sent out a deals newsletter. LA to Denver, 86 round trip on United. New York to Milan on American Delta for under $500 round trip.
Wow.
So
very nice.
Get out there. See the world.
JohnnyJett.com. Thank you, Johnny. He's been everywhere, man. We're going to get back to Abel. Abel did a mitzvah. He did a nice thing. Elderly gentleman, had an old Lenovo ThinkPad, older computer. Hey, it was old enough, maybe it was still from the IBM era, running Windows XP. Abel said, I can help. Now he can't log in. What will he do? What will he do? Well, he did the right thing. He called the tech guy. We'll help him solve that problem and answer all of your questions at 888-ASK-LEO. If you've got a tech problem, a question, a comment, a suggestion, I'd love to hear from you. And don't forget the website, techguylabs.com. Leo Laporte, more of your calls coming up. I am the Tech Guy. Hit you with your best shot. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Thanks to Nathan Staten, our musical director, spinning the discs. Heather Hammond, our phone ranger, taking the calls. And Abel, who has been so very patient, but you don't have much choice, do you, Abel? you're in a desperate situation. So
I am.
Somehow you made it so he couldn't log into his XP machine. What did you do? What changes did you make?
So the only thing I did at first was replace the CPU fan. That's it.
Wow, that shouldn't log him out. Okay.
It sure shouldn't.
Yeah.
He tells me he has like this remote desktop support that he's using and for the last couple of years. And I made a mistake, which is I assume that oh, he has helped us check. Like, he must have a backup, a recent one.
He doesn't have a backup.
He doesn't.
Oh, lordy, lordy.
I have, so I use like a boot CD with some utilities, and the hard drive looks fine. I reset the administrator password, and I change the password back to the one he thinks it is.
Oh, okay. So you were able to get in as an administrator.
Right.
Oh, well, that's good news. So his data is not lost because the administrator can always get that data and back it up.
Okay.
So that's the good news.
Good to hear.
Yeah, as long as you have some access to the system, you'd have to probably take control, take permissions for his folder. But as administrator, you can do that. So, in fact, you can Google, take control of files in XP as administrator. And it's a very simple thing to do. It just involves changing the properties for the files. So that would get you a backup. So he's not lost any data. Good news.
Okay.
Now, he, of course, worst case, what you could do is you could create a new account for him and then as administrator move his old data into his new account.
Mm-hmm.
And then just delete his old account. This isn't your fault. He forgot his password.
Yeah.
And he may never have had to log in before. He may have it set just to automatically log in. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden he can't, and he doesn't know what his password is.
That's right. And he's really distraught. He had this weird, like, Byzantine, like, house card setup.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what anything was.
He
really arrange things on the desktop.
Oh, so he does want his desktop. He doesn't want to lose his desktop.
Right. And he was using old versions of a lot of applications, which aren't even like supported or published anywhere anymore.
So you should be able to, as administrator, go into his account and change the password without knowledge of this old password, I think. Can't you change that in the user profile? Have you tried that?
Yes, I did. And he can log in.
Oh, okay.
In his account. But okay. When he does, there are no files after 2012. It's like the computer is sort of reverted to like some very old state.
Oh.
Where like a lot of the apps the applications he uses.
I had it set up just right, and you screwed it up.
He's been very gracious about
thing,
but he had a stroke a few years ago, and he
wants it the way he wants
hobby.
It. I understand.
He wants it the way it was.
I understand. Believe me, I completely understand. You're doing a mitzvah. You're doing a great thing. Just remember, no good deed goes unpunished. Mm-hmm. And in this case, sometimes it becomes a quagmire, especially with people who have really spent a lot of time, quote, customizing their system. They've made it now so personalized that it's going to be difficult to get back. I'm trying to think of why it would revert. Maybe the profile got damaged. You didn't run a system restore, did you?
No, I didn't.
Sounds like it was restored to 2012 somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's a fix to. So you just changed the password. He's logged into as the same profile. Make sure, are there other profiles on there? Other users?
The ones on there, no, there aren't. There's just his user account and the administrator account, and that's it.
So then we know he's logging into the profile he was using, the account that he was using. And he says, oh, it's all different.
That's right.
Shoot. I don't know why that would happen. I don't think you did any of this, to be honest. All you did is put a fan on the CPU.
Yeah.
Fortunately, you have the administrator password. Did you create an administrator account, or was that already there?
There was already one there.
Okay. And he knew the password to that, or?
No, he didn't. I saw that there was an administrator account there, so I think I was using like a version of Ultimate Boot CD.
Oh, good. You figured it out. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they have Lovecrack on
it. I figured it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to tell you, and I thought you didn't know that. So, okay, good. So, as administrator, you haven't done anything. And you've merely now accessed his system. You've changed his password so he can log in.
Right.
And what looks like has happened is somehow his desktop, it's just the desktop that's different. Or are there files missing?
It looks like there are files missing, too.
Hmm. That's odd.
Yeah.
I can't think of any reason why that would have happened. There's nothing, not with anything you just described.
Right.
It sounds like the hard drive is not in great shape. And it might be that's a case of a hard drive kind of not starting to lose data. There is a program you can run. It's $90. But it sounds like you're a good Samaritan and you want to get off the hook here. My friend Steve Gibson makes a program called SpinRite. You can get it from grc.com. It's not cheap, but what it is perfect for a situation like this where you have a hard drive that might be a little flaky. What it does is you run it on the hard drive, and it may take a while. Like sometimes it can take days because it's going to read sectors that the operating system can't and won't read. The operating system gives up on. And if it can read it, and it might take, hours to get that one sector, it'll move it and effectively restore it. And in many cases, that's for the situation you described, that sounds like the best thing to do. You'll be able to use this in your future life. This is a great tool for maintaining, and it's less of a recovery tool, although we're going to use it that way today. But it's a very good tool for maintaining hard drives. So,
a friend of mine has a copy of it.
Perfect. Yeah. There you go. Borrow your buddy's copy. And if it saves his data, then give a little money to us, Steve. There are directories in there on the hard drive. The user profile directory may have other user profiles there. You might look and see if there are others. It may not be other accounts, but there may be other user profiles. If from the command line, it's percent user profiles percent. That's the variable that will be populated with a path to the user profiles. You could also browse around to find it. Mm-hmm. And it may be there are other profiles in there that somehow just got detached. And the one that you're looking for may be the one that has that crazy house of cards. I've seen lots of people do that. Setup of icons. They act as if, and it's I guess it's a sensible adaptation. You act as if your desktop is somehow a filing system. It's not. It's just a representation of icons. But then you arrange your icons in the desktop just so as a mnemonic, so you know where your stuff is. The problem with that is the desktop file is very fragile, and anything can mess up the icons. For instance, change the screen resolution. And the computer will, especially if you make it a lower resolution, the computer will rearrange all the icons to match the resolution, and there's no getting back. You go back to the old resolution, no, it just keeps the icons where it left them. It's not a robust way, and that's hard to explain to somebody, especially an elder who's really set in his ways. This is not how you should be doing this. And so that's what happens. But inevitably, that's what happens. If you use your desktop as a way to remember where stuff is, and you have lots of folders and all this hierarchy on there. The problem is it's by no means a permanent representation of anything. It's like you painted a picture, and that picture is, you painted it in sand. And in comes the tide, and bye-bye picture. 8888 Ask Leo. Sounds like you're doing all the right things. You've got the right tools. I would look in that user profile just to see if there's some extra user profiles lying around. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, I want to talk to you about optical cables. It's Corning time. Corning. US 3-dot optical cables. This is the Thunderbolt. They also have a USB 3.0. So why optical? Well, Both USB and current Thunderbolt uses copper cables, right? But optical, as you know, fiber optics is more efficient. So with an optical cable, these are lighter. They're really thin. And they can go a lot farther than a copper cable. And Corning's done some really smart stuff in here. They actually have, and it's, you know, it's not very big. If you're watching the video, you can see it. An adapter on the plug-in that actually takes the copper bits and turns them into optical bits. So this is a little light transmitter receiver on this. It's not very big. They've also figured out, and this is really where Corning excels, they figured out how to make these cables much more robust than previous optical cables. When we first got our SAN, our storage area network, it's got fiber optic connecting the SAN to the network for speed. But the engineer said, oh, don't step on that. Watch out for the orange cable. It's very fragile. It's glass in there. Well, I'm here to tell you, Corning, the masters of glass, they have figured out cables you can do this to. I'm tying a knot in it. You can crimp. In fact, let me show you. I have a special little setup here with a laser. This kind of simulates the data transmission on an optical cable. It's a little blinking red laser. You can plug this cable into the laser so the light will pass. And yeah, you can still see it. You can see it blinking coming out that end. So I can tie it. And this cable's been through the mill. I can tie it in knots. I can crimp it. I can stuff it into this little crimper that they provided me with here. And it still works. It takes a bending and it keeps on sending. And so this is the new, this is not your grandfather's fiber optic cables. 60 meters, 200 feet for Thunderbolt, 50 meters, 165 feet for USB 3. So now you can like store that noisy, loud, hot drive. See, it's still blinking. USB 3.0 optical and Thunderbolt optical cables. Optical cables by Corning.com. For long throw, lightweight, flexible, really great cables, you got to go Corning. Optical cables by Corning.com. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers and the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, anything with a chip in it. 8888 Ask Leo. It's your respite from politics, religion, sex. None of that. None of that. Just digital technology. 8888 Ask Leo. The website is techguylabs.com, and I do put links on the website to everything we talk about. Actually, I don't do it. James DeRuvo does it as we're talking. And then Josh Windisch will add audio and video of every show to the website, techguylabs.com, and it's all free. There's no sign-up. So just keep that in mind if you're listening and you say, what was that? It's there. It's all there. You don't have to say, what was that? Derek joins us next from Hemet, California. Hi, Derek.
How you doing, Leo?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, good. I got a couple questions. I'm an Army vet. I'm getting ready to start aviation school next month.
How exciting. You're going to be a pilot?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm going to be a helicopter.
Oh, wow. How fun.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. It's been a dream of mine ever since I was a little kid. So it's awesome. That
ever since Magnum PI, right?
Yeah.
Awesome.
My question is, what laptop would you suggest for something like that, you know, for school and aviation and whatnot?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on what software they're using, but I would call the school and ask them. And this is true of any school that you're going to. A lot of people call in the next few months will call about their kids going off to college for the first time. What computer would be good for that? And really, the expert is the school itself because they'll know what software. So I don't know if there's a flight simulator you guys need to use or there's testing software you need to use. So that will help you determine the kind of the basic thing, which is what operating system to use. Do you need to have Windows? Do you need to have Mac? Do you need to have, will Chrome OS be sufficient? Chrome OS is always a good choice if all you're doing is basic surfing, email, word processing, spreadsheets, because it's secure, it's inexpensive, it's very reliable. And I generally, you know, when I hear these calls like our last caller with an older guy with Windows XP, I just feel like, the poor guy's been suffering with Windows for years. Mm-hmm. And it's overkill. Now, for you, it may not be. It just depends on what the school's expectations are. If all you have to do is write papers and take online tests, anything would do. But if there's some special software you need to run, so I would ask them. I would find out.
Okay.
And you're probably going to want a laptop. Most students like laptops because you can take it home. You can have it in class. You can bring it around. And there are a lot of – that means generally you want lightweight, long battery life. There are some very good choices in that arena, both Windows and Mac.
What would you prefer? Do you prefer Mac over Windows? Or
I do, but that's personal. I mean, it's a personal preference. There's, you know, if you're a gamer, for instance, you'd be crazy to buy a Mac. You should buy a PC. It may well be that I don't know if there's simulators that you guys use in the early days. You know, for instance, just if you know, one of the things you have to learn is the control console and what all those dials and meters and buttons and knobs do. And an easiest way to do that is not in a helicopter, but in a simulator. And there may be software that they use. I'm just guessing here. I have no idea. There may be software that they use to get you familiar with that, but I don't, with the instruments, but I don't know. So you just ask them, is there any particular software I need to run? Lenovo makes really excellent high-end, lightweight laptop computers that are for Windows that are highly prized. But there are lots of choices in the what they call Ultrabook category now. It may be that you'll want something like a Surface Pro that has a touch screen and stylus. It may be that for the kinds of things you're going to be doing, I just don't know. And that's why you ask the bursar at the school or other students. Are you going to take the laptop in the air with you? Then you might want something that's more tough. You know, Panasonic for years made the Toughbooks to military specs, which meant you could throw it around, you could take it to the desert, you could get it wet. Yeah,
I remember having one of those.
Yeah. They're not pretty.
No.
They're not lightweight.
No, take it through the desert and bounce around that Humvee pretty well.
They handle a Humvee ride very well. Yeah, and that's exactly what you'll see, you know, in Humvees. But it may not be something that you need, and it certainly wouldn't be the most desirable computer for personal use. You know, not the battery life's terrible, that they're ugly and they're heavy.
Oh, yeah.
So I just don't know is what I'm saying. But, you know, there are a lot of – the good news is choice on the Windows side is huge. Lots of good choices out there. I do like ThinkPads from Lenovo. Dell makes a great line of inexpensive laptops. I have the Dell XPS 13, which I – you know, just as a kind of, it's not inspiring necessarily in terms of looks, but it's lightweight, it's powerful, it's got a beautiful screen. Highly recommend it. It's a perfect student laptop, but again, it depends what you need. MacBook Airs and the Mac, by the way, there'll be new MacBooks announced next, we think, on the 21st, a week from Monday. So might be prudent if you're buying a laptop from Apple to wait and see if they announce new ones, because we expect they probably will.
Okay.
But, you know, you can't really go wrong, to be honest with you, unless there's a specific program you have to use. I love Macs. I think they're more expensive, but they're made with higher quality components in general. That's one reason. The other reason they're more expensive is the support is very good. On a PC, unless you pay for support, you're not going to get good support.
Yeah, and that's what I always would like to get is the Mac. And then my second question is, you know, money is an issue.
Of course.
Do you know of an organization or a website that helps us vet accumulate a laptop or helps us with a big discount?
Wouldn't that be great? In chat room, I'm putting it to you and the vast listening audience. Let's get this vet, man who served our country, set up in his new career. I love that idea, and I just don't know off the top of my head.
I've emailed, you know, Apple, I've emailed Dell, you know, 10 years in the Army, 2 tours overseas. I'm like, you know, help. Can you guys, you know, help out a little bit? You know, and I haven't heard nothing back from anybody.
Yeah, I would check with the local vet organization, see if it, if they know of anybody. Because I think that, I agree, you deserve it. You earned it. And I think you deserve the help, so... Apple does have a military discount, but you're not in the military anymore. They do also have a refurb, an outlet, what they call an outlet store, that's direct from Apple. But they don't. We're talking $100, $200. It's not a huge savings.
Okay.
Yeah. But we'll keep listening and seeing. I'll keep my eye on the chat room. Keep listening, and if we can find a discount for you, Apple also has an educational discount. I think it's around 10%.
Okay.
But yeah, those are expensive computers. That's the real drawback. They're kind of They're pricey. You can get some really an inexpensive Windows computer, going to give you all the power. You know, I mean, there's really no reason not to get, say, a Dell.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Hey, good luck.
All right, thank
you. Where are you going to fly, commercial or what kind of helicopters?
Well, you know, at first you start off, you know, something like with the tour companies, you know, right. Grand Canyon, Las Vegas, until you accumulate enough hours. And then after that, you know, the sky's the limit.
I'll probably be in one of your helicopters. My wife loves helicopter rides. She's done She's done Boulder Dam in Vegas. She's done Hawaii. I think she wants to do a helicopter ride in New York. So we'll probably be in. I'll look for you.
Yes, sir.
Yes. All right, Derek. Hey, good luck to you.
Thank you.
All right. And thanks so much for your service. 10 years. It's a long time. That's great. Sure. Really appreciate it. A tough time. VeteransAdvantage.com. Dell has some military benefits on that page. Thank you, Low Tech. We'll put a link to that in our chat notes at techguylabs.com. Militarybenefits.info. Thank you, Level Day. That's another place to look. Apple has some military benefits, so there are places out there. Ah, the Apple military discount is good for vets. Good to know. Good to know. Militarybenefits.info. Thank you, Lovell. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 888-88-ASK-LEO. That's the number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Let's go to Honolulu, my good friend Ellie. Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm hanging in. I have a question for you.
All righty.
All right. I have a friend that she has no cable in her house or anything like that. She's not getting any, but she wants an iPhone, and she has no Wi-Fi. So I was wondering, is there a device she can get so she could still use all the features of the iPhone?
Yeah. So the iPhone, but she doesn't want to pay for an internet connection through the phone company.
Right.
So she basically wants an iPhone that's not on the internet.
Right.
Period.
Right. Yeah. Is there like a portable Wi-Fi device she can get?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So she's willing to buy some internet. She just...
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's one of the... But she doesn't need a phone. She just wants the apps, that kind of stuff.
Right. But she wants the phone, and she wants the apps, and she wants...
Well, the phone has... You can't buy an iPhone without a data plan, so there will be a data plan. So she doesn't need anything.
She wants, like, unlimited data, but...
Oh, I see.
Because she uses it with, like, a device, so she could still have some Wi-Fi.
I'm not sure I understand, Ellie. She buys an iPhone, it's going to have an internet connection everywhere.
Right.
She doesn't need Wi-Fi unless she has other devices. Does she have other devices, too?
No, she's not computer literate.
Okay. So tell her to get an iPhone from a company that offers unlimited data, like Sprint or T-Mobile.
T-Mobile, right.
Yeah. And then she can use it to her heart's content. She doesn't need the Wi-Fi adapter unless she's got other devices she wants to use.
No, she doesn't have other devices.
Yeah.
So I didn't know she could use all the features without Wi-Fi.
Oh, yeah, you don't need Wi-Fi.
Okay.
You only need an internet, a data connection from your phone company, which, of course, if you're buying an iPhone, you have to get. Now, you can get, in effect, an iPhone without data, which is called an iPod Touch, but it's not a phone. It's just... It's
right,
the iPhone without
that.
She wants a phone and she wants internet access.
Right.
Just go to T-Mobile or Sprint. Both offer unlimited data plans that are fairly affordable. T-Mobile's is very affordable. In fact, T-Mobile has the one I usually tell people about is it's a pay-as-you-go deal from T-Mobile that is $30 a month. And you get unlimited data. And unlimited texting, but you get a limited amount of calls. I think only 100 minutes of calls or 200 minutes of calls. Now, you should maybe she'd want. Well, she says she wants an iPhone, huh? Because you could also get something like Google Fi. The Google Internet service now is available for anybody, but you have to buy a Google Nexus phone. The nice thing about that is it uses T-Mobile, Sprint, and Wi-Fi if available. So she can go in a coffee shop and use it. And it's very affordable. You pay $20 for unlimited text and phone calls, and then you pay $10 a gigabyte for data. But you know what? She'll be happy with Sprint or T-Mobile. Both of those. Take a look at that.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
$30 a month. She's not going to be able to get a MiFi card for less than that.
No. Okay.
Yeah, I think don't worry about the Wi-Fi. The data that comes with the phone will be fine.
Okay, so I'll tell her to stay away from Verizon and AT&T.
Well, that's my advice. Okay. I don't know. You know, all of the guys now, all of these companies now are competing, thank goodness. Thank you for competition. And it's become pretty clear that customers want unlimited data. The problem is with a cellular system, unlimited data turns out to be kind of hard to do and costly for them. Because they have to run the internet data to every cell site, right? The cell site is what's providing the internet. And those cell sites are shared by anybody in the area. So they have to, you know, run a lot of data out to each cell site. And if there's a lot of, in an urban area like Honolulu, where there's a lot of people using it, that can add up for them. That can cost a lot of money for them. And if they don't put enough data at the cell site, then it's slow. And, you know, people don't want slow. Everybody wants fast. And more we're using our cell phones to watch movies and stream audio. We're using a lot of data. And so, you know, they have to upgrade their cell sites a lot. It's not inexpensive for them. It is a challenging thing to do. And so, I always come down on the cell phone companies. And usually it's rightly so. But I think to be fair, we should mention that, you know, unlimited data on a cell phone is a harder thing to do than, let's say, unlimited data on your home internet connection. Gary, Wichita, Kansas, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Leo. Enjoy your show. Don't understand much of it, but enjoy it.
It'll sink in. Osmosis.
No, it isn't. We've got a cable provider that has the modem, and our telephone goes through the modem, which is cool. But we're going to get rid of the telephone, which means we need to buy our own modem. And I wondered, what kind of modem should we get?
So your provider, the cable company, will list modems that it allows. You have to use something they recommend.
Buy the cable's modem, the cable company's modem.
Don't buy their modem. That'll be junky. It'll be used. So, you know, if you look on Amazon, I'll tell you where I got my recommendation from, a site I recommend a lot called The Wire Cutter thewirecutter.com. And they recommend the Motorola surfboard cable modem. And there's a couple of different ones. But you first have to verify that it's compatible with your company's service.
Great.
In particular, find out if the company will do something called DOCSIS, D-O-C-S-I-S 3. DOCSIS 3 is the current standard for high-speed cable modems. You know, and a lot of these cable D-O-C-S-I-S.
Say again.
DOCSIS, D-O-C-S-I-S. And the current standard is DOCSIS 3. The reason I say that is that modem you have may be a DOCSIS 1 or 2 modem, if it's been in service for a while, and not giving you the fastest speed that's out there. But the modems recommended by the Wire Cutter, like the one they prefer, which is the Motorola Surfboard, comes from a company. Motorola's modems were bought by Aeris. The Motorola Surfboard SP6141.
Okay.
And that's the one I bought. It's actually Aeris. I guess they've rebranded it. ARRIS now. And that's about $70 on Amazon.
Okay.
And that, you don't have to pay the monthly rent. You know, that's $70 in a year. Yeah. You'll be making money. Well, you won't be making money.
The only reason we worked is we had the phone. I finally talked my wife out of the phone.
Yeah.
So now we can get our own modem.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah, it's a good idea. A lot of times the modems that they use are old, worn out. And you're paying $5 a month rent for it, so
yeah.
Or sometimes more.
When my wife wanted the phone service, you know, that's what we.
Yeah, did. You have to. You have to use theirs.
Now that I've talked her out of the phone service, so that's cool. So I'll go to wirecutter.com after I call my company.
Yeah, yeah. See what they recommend. I bet you anything they're using Aeris modems now. So Aeris is kind of the brand, and. They, for some reason, they say Motorola surfboard on the box and Aeris surfboard on the actual device. Talk about confusion. 8888-ASK-LEO. Leo Laporte, The Tech Guy. More of your calls still to come. And we will indeed put this in the show notes so you don't have to remember anything. Just go to techguylabs.com. It's free. No sign up. Yeah, this is the one I got. You can get one. Yes, you could. You could get the 6121 for less. And that's fine. Actually, probably for most people, that's fine. I don't know why I bought this one for some reason. 6141. I bought it because the wire cutter said to get it. And I've been using Aris forever. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. Back to the phones we go to Tarzana, California. Christian on the line. Hi, Christian.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Welcome to the show. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, how timely you just talked about Epson EcoTanks because...
did you get one? You
know, based on your recommendation, I went out and got a couple of them, actually.
Nice. How do you like them?
I love them.
This is an unsolicited, unpaid testimonial, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. Yes. You know, we have a frozen yogurt shop, and we do a lot of printing in our shop.
Oh, great.
For little promotions and stuff. Yeah. And so these are great. You know, you can print in color, and you can come up with a flyer, and you want to come up with a couple of things, you know, to give to your customers. And,
yeah, what a good idea. You know,
they work out great. They really
butt coming along, though.
There is a big butt. So I went out and got the ET4550 for...
Yep, that's the one we have at home,
Right, for the shop. And I loved it so much, I wanted to get one for home. So I decided, well, I don't do, you know, as much printing or I don't need as much scanning at home. And so I went and got the 2550.
Okay.
And one of the features that I love most about this is the scan to cloud.
Isn't that great? I do that all the time.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. However, the 2550, I guess, doesn't support it.
Now, oh, man.
Yeah. Online, it says it does.
Oh.
But when I went and created the profile, it's just not there.
Well, my, you know, so, okay, so I have a 4550, so I don't have the 2550, so I don't know. If it says online that it supports it, it may just be that the menu system is different and you're not looking in the right place. It's really, I just don't know because I don't have that one. But I do love the idea that, so what you do is you tie it into your Google account, and you have to make sure Cloud Print is set up on your Google account. You did that, right? Or you're scanning the cloud, not printing.
Yeah, scan.
Okay. Oh, that's fine. So you have to give it your Google credentials so it knows where to stick it. And then in the settings, when you turn the scanner on, you can say where you want it to go. Now, are you doing that from the computer or from the printer?
From the printer itself. You know, I used to have an HP, and you had to touch like a million buttons in order to scan something to your computer or via email. With this, you touch a couple of buttons, and it goes.
Yeah.
It even supports it on an older Epson printer that I have. So
I love this feature because you scan to, and it's great for like when my wife will say, well, can you send me a copy of a document? I will scan to the cloud and then share the cloud link, and I don't have to give her, you know, I don't have to email it to her or whatever. It's just in the cloud there.
Yeah, and you can preset a whole bunch of emails, you know, if you have different people to send it to and whatever. So
you've set up you have an Epson Connect account, or you wouldn't be able to do this, right? And you tried to log, and you've logged into the same Epson Connect account on both printers.
I set up two different accounts.
Oh, okay.
One for the home printer and one for the Menchie's printer. So
other thing that it could be that your firmware needs to be updated. Maybe they added this feature later. So do check to make sure you have the right firmware, and that's actually easy to do on these printers. You just, when you're at home, surf to your printer's address, the IP address of your printer, and it'll open up a page and tell you what, you know, then you can upgrade the firmware.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, okay. It might just be that the firmware was out of date. You know, sometimes that happens. They put them in the box, and then they update the firmware to add capabilities later. So thanks to the chat room for that.
Wonderful.
Okay, and then I'll put a link in the show notes to the scan to the cloud help page on the Epson site. There might be something in there that triggers in your mind. Oh, I could do that. So I'm not sure. I'm just not sure. It works for me. I use it all the time. And it works for you, right? You use it on your 4550.
It works. Yeah, yeah, it works at the shop. Great.
It's got to be something with the setup. Or it could be, I bet it's a firmware. Maybe the firmware is not up today.
Okay, I'll look
check
into that
out.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the unsolicited testimonial. I should mention Epson's a sponsor. And just because a company's a sponsor doesn't mean they get free ads in the middle. But hey, if somebody calls and wants to say he likes it, I can't stop him. What am I supposed to do? Say no? No. Hope in Hemet. There is hope. Hi, Hope. Leo Laporte.
I have a difficult time with pictures showing up on some website. Well, almost every website. Then I.
So when you get to the website, you see the text.
But no pictures.
But no pictures. And you were seeing it before you upgraded to Windows 10, or is this a new computer?
No, I upgraded to Windows 10, and it comes back. But, and then it periodically disappears.
Oh, so sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not.
And then if you go to the website and the pictures are there, but you click a secondary link within the website, there's no pictures.
Oh. Sounds like they're not loading. If you refresh, press F5 to refresh the page, sometimes holding down the shift key will help. Does it then load them?
No. The only cure I've found so far was there's a little, like a page with a folded down corner, and you click that on, and it says it's blocked all the images.
Oh!
And then, so I...
Well, you didn't tell me you'd blocked all... So there's something on there blocking images.
I didn't do that. It just did it by itself.
Are you using Internet Explorer?
No. I was... but then, because when I first got Windows 10, it would not allow you to use Google.
Right. It doesn't come with Google. You have to get it.
And no, it wouldn't work at first. But then they fixed it since then. So now I can get on Google Chrome, and I can get my I can get to my Gmail now. But I'm still having the problem with some sites will load pictures and some sites will not. And I've gone through the list, and I've gone through... that little ad block thing, and...
Oh, you have an ad block?
All the pictures.
I got to take a break. I hear the magic music. Hold on. We're going to solve this, but we're going to have to do it after these fine words from our sponsors, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by the Epson EcoTank printers. Somebody, we were talking about Epson's 2550, and I think that doesn't do cloud print. I think that that's the issue. Somebody said it's not in the manual. But I'll tell you what, there's a whole range of Epson EcoTank printers. And the reason people are loving these is because they all come with about 2 years of ink in the box. So you no longer do you have to stop in the middle of a print job and run to the store and get more cartridges. Incredible. Incredible. I just love these printers. The 4550 comes with, see the tank on the side there and the bottles in the box. Enough ink to print 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages. That's about 50 ink cartridges worth. And then when it's time to get new ink, you save 80%, up to 80% on ink with their low-cost replacement bottles. But it's not just for home. It's for office, too. They've got workgroup printers that'll print even more, like the WFR4640, 20,000 pages. And when you run out, you buy the economical ink packs. Now you have the freedom to print without running out of ink. And by the way, all of these printers feature Epson's amazing precision core technology, which I love. Epson brought this up from their industrial printers. 40 million droplets per second means you get super crisp black and white printing, laser quality black text, high speed. You know, for me, it's about 3 seconds a page. It just goes and it's done. Vivid colors. And you get all the benefits of a great inkjet printer, including auto two-sided printing. That saves me a lot on paper. I do it all the time. I just feel better about it, you know. 30-page auto document feeder that really works. And, yes, wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. I love these printers. You will too. I want you to go to Epson.com/ecotank to learn more. EPSON.com/ecotank and learn what the amazing Epson EcoTank printers could do for you and for your business and for your home. We already had an Epson Precision Core printer, the Workforce Pro, and Lisa really wanted the EcoTank. So she said, I want my own printer. Now I print on her printer because it never runs out of ink. EcoTank from Epson. Go to EPSON.com/ecotank. Epson, exceed your vision. Nathan Staten, our musical director, bidding for the Best Musical Director Academy Award in the whole wide world. Phone Ranger Heather Hammon, ditto, Best Phone Ranger in the whole wide world. I have a great team working with us here on the Tech Guy Show, and none better than this guy right here, Dick DiBartolo. He's Mad Magazine's maddest writer, a living legend, and he's also our gizwiz because he comes up with great, crazy, fun gadgets each and every week. Hello, Dickie D.
Leo, how you doing?
I am wonderful.
You're looking great. You look super.
78 degrees or something in New York, right? I mean, it's crazy.
Today's only 60, but Thursday it was 79. In Newark, it was 81.
What the what? So yeah, we're coming to New York briefly. I'm probably not going to get to say hi because we're just there for a couple of days to see Hamilton.
Okay.
But
oh, my gosh. Okay.
I know. But can you make the spring last a little longer, right? Like March 23rd, 24th, thereabouts?
Yeah. Okay. You know who wrote and starred in Hamilton,
who?
Right?
Medina.
Lin-Manuel. Right. Okay.
Did you know him?
Leo, I know him indirectly. Out of the blue, a month ago, the editor of Mad came in and sat down and said, you are not going to believe this. I said, what? He said, Lin-Manuel Miranda just tweeted, as long as Dick DiBartolo is writing for Mad, everything is well with the world.
That's true.
I don't know. You should ask him
for Hamilton tickets now.
I emailed back and I said, you made my day. He said, sir, you have made my childhood.
Oh.
He's the hero of
Broadway now. I mean, everybody, yes. he is the hottest thing out there. That show is sold out to 2017. They have a lottery each day for tickets, for the few handful of tickets.
And you're going to see it?
I am going to see it on the 24th. God. I'm very excited.
You have to let me know.
Yeah. You haven't seen it?
No. I have the album. But
Lin-Manuel is a fan.
I know. I don't want to push the favor.
Come on, Nick. You got to tweet him. Hey, by the way, you can return the favor for years of entertainment with a couple of hours in your show.
Maybe.
What the? Maybe. Come on, Dickie D.
I don't want
to. You're like me. I don't like to do that either.
Yeah, no.
I don't like to say, do you know who I am? I didn't do that. I don't pull strings.
I stood outside the Brick House for 3 days before.
I wouldn't let you in.
I know.
Wouldn't let you in. No, just teasing.
All right, so we have a gadget. It's another look into the future for Christmas from Toy Fair, from Lionel.
Yeah.
Lionel, for 70 years, been making trains.
And I know you're a train fanatic.
I'm a train fanatic, but this is a departure for them. I met the creative director of Lionel, and I said, Dick, we wanted to do something with a track, but we wanted it to be totally different and very creative for kids. Mm. So they came out with a new system. It's coming out in late August or early September, called Megatrax. Megatrax is a single track that kids can attach to anything. Comes with every kind of connector. Attach it to furniture. You can hold it in the air.
You can run it
from room to room. There's a little car that clamps onto the track. And the fun thing is determining how to build it. You can build it with super tight turns, but you have to be very careful how you run the car through the tight turns. The cars can run upside down.
So it's kind of like a slot car system, slot car racing.
Yes, exactly. A slot car system with a very bendable, customizable.
Oh, forget
track.
Kids. I want this.
I was going to say, I said to the guy, kids. I said, first of all, I think my taxi driver drove exactly this way on the way to the convention center.
Oh, this is brilliant.
It's going to be a great thing for anybody who's a kid at heart.
Now, you saw this at Toy Fair, so it's not out yet.
No, it's coming out late August, early September. The initial kit with 20 feet of track and 55 construction pieces will list for $99.99.
Oh, it's pricey.
It's pricey. It's up
there. Wow. But every kid's going to want one of these.
I think so.
Holy cow. I want hundreds of feet.
Yes, on you.
It looks like
your house.
I went all over that. But you can remote control the car. Is that an app that they're using? Or
yes, yes. It's the controller that comes with the car so that you can control.
But then you put your phone in the controller and run the
app.
That's
right. Exactly.
Brilliant.
Exactly. Yeah, it's clever, isn't it?
Brilliant.
A little different than trains that run on standard tracks.
You know, instead of cracking encryption, they should just get these, and terrorists will be so distracted that we won't have to worry anymore.
Perfect.
This looks so much fun. Perfect. Dick DiBartolo is at gizwiz.biz. That's his website. No .com. It's .biz. So it's gizwiz.biz. You can play the What the Heck Is It contest. Brand new contest. Just started at the beginning of the month. New chance to win autographed copies of Mad Magazine from Lin-Manuel Miranda's favorite writer. Wow. You can also watch GizWiz the show. You have a show, too. It's the GizWiz the Musical.
I do. Isn't that interesting?
Yes. At Giz, I bet he's a GizFizz fan. GizWiz.tv. GizWiz.tv if you want to watch the show and help out, contribute, and all of that. Thank you, Dickie
you,
D.
Sir. Thank
Wonderful.
You.
Wonderful. You come on. Tweet him back. Tickets. Yeah. I don't want to be that guy, but tickets. No, just say, hey, for decades of entertaining you, all I'm asking is a couple of hours.
Well, evidently he stands at the stage door and walks up and down the audience before every show. So when you see him, say, hey,
I will say, Lin, I'm a friend of Dickie D.
There you go. There you go.
Wow. I can't believe you, of all people, you live in Manhattan. You're a huge Broadway show fan.
I know.
It's hard to get in. It's very hard to get tickets.
I know. And that's why I feel like pushy.
I'll push for you. I'll be your agent.
Oh, okay.
When I see him, I'll say, Lin-Manuel.
Yeah.
I know Dick DiBartolo. And you are no Dick DiBartolo.
Yeah, you do that. Do that after the show.
After the show. Hey, thanks, Dickie D. We'll talk again next week. So I hope I've been doing some research behind the scenes as we've been trying to figure out your problem. It sounds like something is running on your system that is blocking stuff. Maybe Flash. Do you have a Flash blocker? Are you running security software of any kind?
ESET.
Is it the... So I wonder if ESET is trying to protect you from something. Now, when you look at the image, is there a red X where the images would be?
No.
Can you right-click on the image and say, load this image, and it loads?
No.
So something's blocking it. And I see this little tab in my head that you're talking about, this little page turn, and behind it it says, oh, you want to load these images? That's some software that's not normal that's running in the background blocking those images. And what we have to do is figure out what that software is. You said you use Chrome now? Look in your Chrome extensions. So you go to Chrome settings, and there's extensions. And look and see if you have an ad blocker, a flash blocker, that might be doing it, or something else. Look for the word block, because there's something in your system that is doing this. This is not normal behavior. It's something that's been installed. Maybe you have a kid or a friend who's helping you. It doesn't sound right, and it doesn't sound normal. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, we're out of time, but we'll be back next time, and I hope you will too. Have a great Geek Week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts. For this show, we talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security and security now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.